Welcome to Theatre Audience Podcast. I'm Natalie, joined by Darren, and we bring you the news, reviews and recommendations of the latest theatre.
We'll be discussing what's on, what's been and gone, and the next hot ticks.
Guten Tag, Darren.
Guten Tag, Natalie. Greetings from Berlin. How are you?
I'm great. I've had a lovely half term. Very, very relaxing. And how has the Berlin Film Festival been for you?
It's been manic. Like, watching films, having meetings, you know, catching up with life in Berlin. It's a wonderful city. Have you been before?
Yeah, babe. I've done the Christmas markets a couple of times now. I went Christmas before last.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was there a couple of years ago as well with the ex. But this is a very different experience. And this is, it's almost work. I mean, obviously, I'm having a good time hanging out and doing stuff. And I've got friends here who are based in Berlin, which is lovely. But meeting new people and just being part of the vibe, it's quite a crazy place, really. I definitely recommend going to a film festival abroad. I think this is my first one abroad, actually. Most of the ones I go to are the UK. So yeah, really, really good.
You've not done Cannes?
No.
You've not done Cannes Film Festival. That surprises me.
Well, Cannes is a massive film market. So for me, unless I've got something specific to want to sell or a good slate of films, and I'm building my slate, so don't get me wrong, but the main reason I'm in Berlin is because I've got a film being screened that I've made. So it's a different vibe. So I'm actually part of the filmmaking team. So you kind of have a different level of respect, I guess, from your peers and stuff. So it's really exciting. But the Cannes, for me, not this year, no. I'd like to go to Venice this year. Venice is in the end of August, early September, yeah. So Venice, for me, would be an ideal treat, mainly because I love Italy, but also because I love film, of course. So yeah, blend it together in the summertime. Oh, perfect mix.
Yeah. Oh, love Venice. A little trip on a gondola.
Absolutely.
That'd be nice for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which actually, not so much the gondola, but the whole kind of like fantastical lifestyle of screen, as it were, it leads me into what I want to talk to you about first. So when I was in London, at the London Palladium, Candice Bushnell is doing a tour, and she landed in London for one night only, where she was talking about her experience of Sex and the City. Of course, she was the writer and creator of Sex and the City, where she actually had her own column writing about Sex and the City, the New York Times, which led her to write the book, which led the book to be snapped up, to be turned into the TV show, which we all know and love, with the wonderful characters, of course, Carrie Bradshaw as the leading role, which is interesting because I don't know, are you a big fan of Sex and the City?
To be honest, Darren, I really wasn't actually, which people are surprised by. But no, I wasn't really a huge fan. I think I watched a series or so, but I never really, not really.
Okay, well, that does surprise me, actually. That's even what I know about you, but there you go. No, for me, I really love the show, but I didn't really get into it until season two. So when season two was kind of launched on the television, I had a little look and then went back to season one and started from the beginning and then become obsessed with it to the point I bought the box set. You know, I'd watch it on repeat. In back in the days before platform streamers, it was DVDs. And yes, I'm that old. But it's, I've actually still got the box set. I think it's in my garage, but of course, because of the streaming platforms and stuff, we don't really need DVDs anymore, which is quite sad, actually, because I've got some wonderful films and TV box sets there. I really enjoyed it. It's really fascinating hearing the story, how it evolved, how it played out and stuff, and where it all came from, and all the glitz and glamour of the New York kind of elite scene that she's part of now. But it took her a long time to get there. But some fascinating stories and some kind of like old anecdotes and tales and stuff. And going back to the four main characters, which of course is the Samantha, Miranda, Charlotte and Carrie, I consider myself that kind of a cross between Samantha and Carrie myself, I think. Yeah, I can't think I'm one or the other. I think I'm a blend of both. So if they were to have a child, it would be me, I think. Those two there. I'm far from Charlotte, trust me on that one.
I couldn't even tell you which ones I am.
I think you're more Miranda.
I couldn't even tell you which ones I am. I don't know. I don't know if that's a compliment or not. I have an extensive shoe collection.
That's the Carrie.
So I could only identify with the lead character. Well, there you go. See, I have to call her the protagonist because I'm just not. Yeah, I clearly didn't watch it. I think I watched the recent film. I say recent. I don't know when that came out. There was a film where they went to. They go to Dubai or something?
Yeah, they went to the Middle East, yeah.
I can barely remember. I quite enjoyed that, but yeah. Interesting,
I
isn't
know.
It? Is that a big gap in my life?
I think so. I think Sex and the City was...
I watched Friends.
Oh, well, it's a very different show, that one, I'm afraid. You know, HBO...
Very different show, but same time, I suppose, same time period.
It is around the same time period, yeah. And the thing that was important about, say, Sex and the City, especially going into mainstream television, and HBO were very, very brave and very good to bring it on, is it changed the lives of, I think, a lot of women, and it empowered them as well. And also, you know, as a gay man, I think it influenced me specifically, but my kind of, like, if you like, community too. And women, I mean, in the Palladium, obviously the Palladium was a big theatre to fill up, and I think pretty much every seat had gone. Mm. But it was 90% women and 10% gay men. I mean, but the thing is, that's what's so powerful about Candice Bushnell and, you know, the books and her towers and stuff and what she's doing. She empowers women and she helps to do that. You know, she calls herself a feminist. You know, she's doing wonderful things that kind of encourage a more freer spirit of the female identity, I think. And on stage, the stage was quite cute. It's very pink, lots of shoes. There's a nice, like, kind of sofa shoes and orange thing which she would lay on, and the other little kind of bits of furniture knickknacks. So like it would be in a New York Upper East Side apartment of some kind, you know. But she had a lot of shoes on stage, and they're all her shoes. And every so often she'd say shoes, and it all light up. So I think you would have really enjoyed that moment. Yeah, but it was fun. It was really great to hear her.
I talk to my shoes in my shoe library.
You talk to your shoes?
Well, I go in there sometimes because I've got a shoe library. You've seen my shoe library, haven't you? And
I have.
Yeah, they've all got each set of shoes has got its own little cubby hole. I do go in there. Sometimes I go in there and I just say, I haven't worn you for a long time. Because, I don't know, since COVID, we don't really... I say we, Darren. I use that we quite lightly. I don't see so many people walking about in heels. Last night on the Underground, I did see a girl really struggling in a pair of heels on a Monday night, like proper tall heels. And I just thought, even on a night out, the youth of today tend to go for a nice little tight crop top, a baggy pair of jeans, and then they team it with a trainer. There seems to be a massive departure from a feminine heel, which is sad. So yes, I do go in there and sometimes converse with myself, but you know, they do light up because there's lights in the cabinet. But maybe I should start watching Sex in the City from the outset. I think the period of time when Sex in the City was mainly on TV, I was busy living out in the countryside, married. Maybe I wasn't interested in watching Sex in the City. Just didn't appeal to me. Whereas now, maybe more so. I love New York. I love, I don't know. Maybe. Who knows? A bit dated now, though, maybe.
I don't know. I think it's set in a certain period, of course. But I think the conversations the women have together are very relevant even today. I mean, you know, obviously, and Just Like That is the new spin-off season, which has just started finished its second season. I think it's going into being made into its third season, and obviously, as you said, as you mentioned, the books. But what I want to go back to is the whole thing about casting Carrie Bradshaw was very interesting, and I found it quite... I mean, today I don't think they'd have a problem finding actresses, but back when they were casting for the pilot specifically, they had a tough time finding an actress to play the role, because obviously it's quite a prolific, it is a feminist character, there's a lot going on with her, and it wasn't proper, in inverted commas, for women to talk so openly about sex as they did. And apparently, this is literally what Candy said on stage, is that Matthew Broderick suggested his girlfriend at the time, which is Sarah Jessica Parker, go out for the role. And that's how it happened. But it's interesting that it was Matthew Broderick was the biggest star back then. Obviously now, I mean, they're obviously semi-equal, because they're both... they're a married couple, but they're both doing their own things in their own right. But obviously, Sarah Jessica Parker is, in my eyes anyway, a far bigger star than Matthew. But what launched her was obviously Sex and the City. I mean, she had done films beforehand. Mm. She'd done, I think, before that, she had obviously done Hocus Pocus, which is one of my favourite Halloween films. And, of course, films like The Addams Family. and some other bits and pieces, because she was a child star, so she grew up in the industry. But I do think it's interesting that a show that so many apparently actresses turned down became this huge platform for Sarah Jessica Parker to be the massive star that she is today. And without it, you know, I think she'd obviously still be a working actress, but not the big star that she is now. But it was fascinating, and you can see Candice as she was talking or walking around on stage. The whole character of Carrie Bradshaw is her. I mean, it's her life. You know, even the story about Mr. Big and the senator and stuff like that, all these things that she's telling us, who are characters in the TV show, were people that she'd met in real life. And the girls, Samantha, Miranda and Charlotte, they are her friends, and they go for brunch and they do talk openly about sex and men and what they get up to. And, you know, she would note it down. You know, it's I wouldn't say it's verbatim, but it's probably close to it. So, yeah, but sadly, the tour's almost finished. It closes or the middle of February, so it's actually gone now. But it was doing a UK tour. And I think it's one of those things that if she ever comes back and does a talk again, it's worth going to have a listen. She's a fascinating woman, wonderful woman. And even through the hardships that she had, yeah, through her career, there's so much gratitude in the way she speaks, you know. And I think that's a very powerful thing. There's no worries me, and, you know, okay, I was almost homeless and I was living barely on the streets of New York, but I made it work, you know. And she did, and it's a testament to anybody that's got a high spirit and really wants something and goes for it, and this is where you could be. So which actually is interesting, because that leads me into the next person we're going to talk about, which is Tina Turner.
I was just going to say, you know, I'd probably go and see that.
Yeah, absolutely. So go ahead. Tell us about Tina, your experience of Tina Turner the musical.
I was going to say, I would probably go and see that, even though Sex, you know, based on what you said, even though Sex and the City wasn't for me, because I do love a rise to fame story. I do love that, you know, whether it's, you know, film, Rocket Man, or, you know, whatever. I do love a rise to fame story, and therefore... you know, the Tina Turner musical was just for me perfection, because it shows her entire life from being a young girl, you know, through to her phenomenal stage career. And this really is, you've seen it, you saw it a while back, and it just is feel good. If you're going to give it two words, it is a feel-good musical. The production quality, as you'd expect, but it is so incredibly slick. And Caris Anderson was the Tina Turner that I saw, and she was, and I'm going to use that word again, I was looking up synonyms for incredible this morning, but she was incredible. And I've seen her before. She played Diana Ross in Motown on the UK tour. And she also played P.P. Arnold in All or Nothing at the Ambassadors, which was about 7 years ago now. And I also met her years and years ago when she was in a girl band. She was in a band called Stooshy. I don't know if you even remember them. But I was emceeing at a music festival in Bishop Stortford called Kazfest. And she was part of that girl band then who were just having their little rise to fame moment. I think they did a couple of hits and then that was it. There was quite a lot of other girl bands about at the time, so it was quite a saturated marketplace. But yeah, so I mean, she's come on an incredible journey. But she, well, I mean, I think, did you see Caris Anderson when you saw Tina? Because I think they've got two Tinas listed
Saw Crystal.
Yeah,
I saw Crystal.
Yeah, but just the sheer energy. I mean, I was looking through the program, the amount of tracks that she had to sing every night, and some of those notes, just incredible. The choreo, fantastic. The set, the costumes, quick costume changes, and what I loved was that end moment when everyone in the audience gets to stand up on their feet and sing and dance along, and they kind of encourage that. And you can film it, and there's just a lovely atmosphere. I did feel at the end, I don't want to obviously spoil anything, but there's a beautiful moment with lighting, sound, everything, a reveal, and you know, the atmosphere was really fantastic. Yeah, it was brilliant. bit of a badly behaved audience, Darren.
Oh, no, how so?
I don't know. When you go and see a show, you know, some of these big, big shows now, I kind of am waiting for it now, as opposed to, oh, there was a bad... It was like, oh, I expected that there would be... I don't know, just maybe because it's not your normal theatre-going audience. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but, you know, people up and down to the toilet a lot, which you don't normally get in a show. People on their phones, you know, just check their phones, send a quick message, put it back. Like, it's almost as if they feel they're at the cinema, which I don't like it when people do that at the cinema, but I just think, oh, well, we're at the cinema. And I don't know, but with theatre, there's an element of theatre etiquette and respect. There's actually people on stage performing. And I don't know whether it's because I was in the dress circle as opposed to in the stalls. I don't know whether, you know, they kind of think, oh, there's no ushers about, I'll just do what I like. There was two women and they were noisily eating their way through their subways, which were wrapped in, you know, paper, rustly paper. And I'm thinking, how did they even smuggle that into the theatre? Because they don't let you take whole dinners and food in. They must have put it at the bottom of a bag or something. But that was nasty. And they were noisy saliva people eating, which is a real thing for me. I really don't like noisy eating, full stop. And then there was the rustling of the sweets. And you just kind of think, why? I mean, there's moments where the whole show is super, super loud and it's big numbers. It's up tempo. You're thinking, unrustle your paper then, because I wouldn't hear it. But why they have to do it at those absolutely poignant, heartbreaking moments of the story where it's, we've had big, big music and then it is very, very silent, and they juxtapose that elated moment with that very sad, poignant moment. And then you hear someone rustling the sweet and you think, is it really that necessary? Are you that hungry? Are you starving that you need to eat that sweet right now in this moment? Can you not hear? You know me. It really bugs me. But also, I'm sitting there thinking, literally days before that, I've taken 190 people to the theatre, including students who are, 11 and 12 years old, and not one of them did that, because I briefed them on the etiquette of theatre and how important it is that all the other people who have spent a lot of money on their tickets deserve to watch the show without hearing you rustle. You know, I tell them, put your sweets in your lap, unwrap them beforehand. Like, literally, eat as many sweets as you want, guys. Go to town. Have your sugar rush. But please, don't disturb the people around you. And I don't know, it just really annoyed me. But I think for us, it was like one thing after another and after another. So my mum and I kept looking at each other and I was getting really... And then there were people talking. The two in front of me that were doing the sandwich thing, they were also talking quite loud at different points. And so I had to be that person to tap them, not quite on the shoulder, but say, can you stop talking, please? And then there were lots of other people around me that suddenly looked relieved. And I just thought, well, could you not be the person that speaks up? You're really near. I had to lean across four people to do that. I get, you know, maybe they don't want to be those people that end up having that fight. I know, but they're disturbing. I could visibly feel tension and that they were disturbing it for at least 10 people surrounding them. And they did stop, but they'd got the giggles and their shoulders were going, you know, doing a kind of like, oh, we're going to be defiant. We're not going to talk, but we're going to laugh. And I was like, you're in your 30s. It's not like young people wouldn't do that. I don't know. It annoyed me because it did disturb the first act a little bit. But obviously everything that was going on stage was so incredible that I had to put that to one side, and I loved it. Fantastic show. Excellent seats. Thank you again to the school trip. We do love the school trip. Giving me the tickets. And the children that were cast were really strong. They were brilliant. Brilliant voices, brilliant dance moves. What a great show. And it's running until May 2025. So there's ample opportunity. I'll definitely go and see it again. It'd be nice to see it on a night when Crystal's playing Tina to see the difference. But Karis Anderson and the rest of the cast were incredible. The band, just sublime.
Yeah, no, definitely a great show to watch. It's a fun show. I mean, it's a tragic story with a positive ending, and it is her life. I mean, that's the thing, it's a true story. I think obviously some of the more passionate moments, I guess, between the couple were kind of maybe diluted down a little bit, because obviously if it's for an audience, it still has to be an enjoyable show at the end of the day. I mean, the movie was quite graphic, so it's nice that maybe for the musical they've kind of just toned down a little bit more of the violence and stuff. Yeah, it's great. It's really good. And their songs are so good.
Yeah, about that, the violence and stuff, I was just trying to look through and see what they... Have they given it an age? Does it say 14 plus or anything like that? Because I guess that would have had some bearing on it. Because people do take their kids quite young to shows like this, don't they? And then they're presented with some, a bit of graphic violence.
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm guessing it would do. Because, yeah, like you said, you know, domestic violence and stuff is not something necessarily children need to see. Sadly, it happens far too often.
No, absolutely.
And that's a different podcast.
Yeah, and quite interesting, because the little boy that's in the scene, obviously there is a scene there with the belt, and obviously, you know, thinking about it from a safeguarding perspective, from a teacher perspective, and also from a theatre chaperone and film chaperone perspective. You know, there are rules and regulations as to age of child and what they can be involved in on stage and depicted. But that scene was very quick, and I wouldn't say glossed over, but that moment was, you know, for that child on stage, he's literally lifted up, sofa, belt, move, off stage. You know, it was very quick, because I did think about that. But he faces away. So yeah, just interesting, but yeah, not something that you'd take someone under the age of 11 to, certainly not in my mind. But yeah, such great energy, and everyone that came out was buzzing. It's a lovely buzz of all the people coming out of the Aldwych Theatre, walking down the Strand towards Charing Cross Station, and it's just like lovely vibe, obviously enhanced by those wonderful rickshaws that sit outside the big shows playing the music, specifically from that big West End show as you leave. That's really irritating. But people singing along to the rickshaws as they walk down the street. But yeah, great, great, great show. And, you know, Carrie Sanderson, sublime.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
We're moving on from an 80s icon into another 80s musical triumph of us both, which is Just for One Day. Now, we were very fortunate to see previews of this show. It's now gone into press night, and the reviews have been very favourable, especially from the audiences, which I think are possibly more important. And yeah, I words escaped me for this show, to be fair. It was so beautifully told and wonderfully staged, and so simplistically staged in my mind, because it was about storytelling. So it didn't have to have fancy sets and stuff. And it was lovely having the band on the stage at the back, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that made it, because so often when you see a piece of musical theatre, you know, the band are hidden in some way, and for good reason. You know, the musicians don't want to be seen necessarily. They want to be able to stand up, go and have a break when they're not playing their sheet music. But this band was playing constantly throughout. It was a small band. It was just keys, drums, guitars, bass. And yeah, it was just so wonderful. I think having a production that is about the creation of the story of Live Aid and the people united by it, to have not had the musicians live on stage, I think would have deadened it, definitely. It made it electric. And I absolutely loved that. And so often in musicals, they're hidden, they're in the pit. They maybe get revealed at the beginning of the second act or at the end for the finale. I think that's why I like Guys and Dolls so much, the fact that you knew that they were up in that little bandstand elevated throughout, and you could look up at that whenever you wanted. But it just, yeah, it enhanced it no end. And you know, the equivalent, obviously, of a bit of a jukebox musical, because you've got all the songs of Bob Dylan, The Who, U2, Queen, Police, Elton John, The Status Quo. I mean, it goes on and on, doesn't it? Boomtown Rats, Paul McCartney, David Bowie, and on and on and on. And it was a cast of 26 on stage pretty much all of the way through. And the energy was fantastic. And from the moment, I just loved the set with all those, like the Fresnels, they were just hanging. There was like a row of like, what was it, like 15 by 6 of the lights. And then when they went up and then the band came forward, it was just beautiful. So many times I got the old goosebumps and the, you know, your hairs raised on your arm, and just, it was so strong.
It was. And the set designed by Sutra Gilmore, again, it was great because it was the stuff that's going on, obviously, on the stage at Live Aid. It was the set pieces where it was in the record shop and stuff like that. Very well thought out, wonderfully designed, and it flowed so well. So the stage being obviously with the band at the back, coming backwards and forwards depending on what part of the show they were in, worked so well, because you felt like you was part of that gig, that one day in the mid 80s. You know, I when I saw it, we saw it at different times because we couldn't get the time to see it together. I was actually sitting next to Luke Shepherd and his associate directors, and I met him a couple of times before, so it was really nice to see him again. But it was fascinating being that close to the director whilst he's noting his show and watching it. I mean, he must have watched it up 10 times, because obviously he's there every day fixing things, shortening things, all sorts of stuff, as what directors do when the show's in previews. And I said to him, so what's different from yesterday? He said, we just tweaked a few bits, shortened it a bit, done this, that. So I really want to see it again towards the end of its run and see how it's really formed and how everyone's settled into their roles. I mean, what's wonderful as well is it's an incredible ensemble piece, because there is no real stars. Obviously, Craig Yales, who plays Bob, I mean, it's a central character. And you've got the Suzanne character from the 80s and from the present time, wonderfully played in the older generation by Jackie Clune, and then the younger version of Hope Kenner. A wonderful, wonderful piece. And I believe Hope is a graduate from drama school. So it's one of her first major roles, and that's a wonderful piece to be in. So yeah, it was great. And I mean,
Jackie Clune, I saw her quite recently. She was in that Grenfell piece at the National Theatre, in the words of Survivors. She was, because I was watching her, I was like, where have I've seen her really close. I've watched her really, you know, because I was front row at Grenfell. And so I was like, she felt like just someone I knew, you know, and that was the point of that character. She was just, she was just a member of the public, just an 18-year-old at the time who had put all her savings together to try and get these tickets. And I loved the attention to detail, Darren. Her savings were in her NatWest pig. They were in the NatWest pig. And so I just loved that, because, you know, in 1985, I was a 7-year-old girl, so all my savings were in a NatWest pig at the time. At the time, they were in the boy, not the girl, because, you know, as you saved £100, you got the next. Did you have the Nathaniel pigs? The NatWest pigs? Yeah.
Yeah, I've got them. Yeah, but you only had to save £100 to get Sir NatWest.
The next one, yeah. But I was only 7 years old.
No, it's so five. It's the family. It's the five pigs.
Was it £100 to get him?
£100 to get them all, yeah. It wasn't that much. But I guess for a child that young, it's quite a lot of money, isn't it, to save up and stuff. So,
I thought you had to get 50. I thought it was you could only get the next pig once you'd hit a certain amount, like 50 quid, and then you got the next one, and then 50 quid, and you got the next one. It took 250 quid to get to the Sir Nathaniel, from what I remember.
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I don't remember. Honey, it was a long time ago. We were children. Oh. I mean, you know, we're middle-aged now.
Yeah.
Sadly. So, long way.
Anyway, but I loved the attention to detail and the fact that, you know, the money came out of that. And, so she was great. And I loved that juxtaposition of her looking back at her young self, and then they had the new generation coming through. I mean, I took my son to see this. He's 18. So that was an interesting slant on it, looking at obviously the incredible impact that creating Band Aid and Live Aid had on raising money and raising awareness. Because I do remember, dancing around the lounge age 7 watching the concert and then seeing those images. And I guess that's something that then carried into, you know, I guess on TV, having things like Comic Relief came after that, didn't it? Where you juxtapose comedians raising money, people pledging through the TV, and seeing the images of you know, where the money was going, where we wanted money to go. But what I thought was quite interesting is that they've said in the programme that 10% of the sale of all the tickets donated goes to Band Aid Charitable Trust. So that's good to know, that by buying our tickets, that money, some 10% of the money is going to help, because the whole piece is about that awareness of the one, what was it, 1.5 billion people, two continents brought together. And the moment the world stood still, where rock and roll brought people together to raise awareness. But what a great piece. I definitely want to see it again. I can't believe it's only on until March the 30th. It's got to have some legs, definitely.
It will transfer. It's a Sonia Friedman show. It will transfer. I mean, the book is written by John O'Farrell, who obviously you know from Mrs. Doubtfire, and you're a big fan of Mrs. Doubtfire. You know, Luke Shepherd is one of our rising stars in British theatre. You might know him from Anne Juliet. Yeah, well, you saw that a few times, didn't you?
And the Little Big Things.
And the Little Big Things
as well.
Yeah, yeah. And also we saw one of his plays. We saw The Da Vinci Code, remember, with Pashenka?
Oh, was that his as well?
Yes.
And I said Pashenka's worked with him. And yeah, My Sons Are Queer, which obviously I saw. I haven't seen it. You saw it.
I saw it, yeah, in the West End, yeah.
When and it won over. Loads of accolades, and then it transferred to Broadway.
And got cancelled.
But yeah, oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. Sadly, which is a big shame, you know, especially because Rob has worked so hard to get that show up and stuff. But I actually don't know the details, but I know it's been cancelled. So yeah. But what I really liked as well about this show were the characters that were playing or they were portraying. And they didn't go into kind of real caricature. It wasn't like anyone specific other than Margaret. So when Margaret Thatcher, who's played wonderfully by Julie Atherton, she's part of the ensemble cast as well. So there's a little bit of costume detail with suggesting who Margaret is. And obviously the voice, you can't, you know, that voice is indistinguishable. And the whole thing of Mrs. T, you want some tea, Mrs. T? Yes, Mr. G. You know, that kind of thing, which is having that song debate with... Bob Geldof. And again, I loved the performance of Getting to the Groove by Tamara Tare, who played Madonna. Again, there was just a little suggestion and costume of who these people are. And obviously, Midger was played wonderfully by Jack Chalut, you know, so, so well done. And obviously someone else you would remember would be Ollie Dobson from Back to the Future. He played McFly, quite a
different
few...
look.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, the 80s again, I guess. Yeah. But I couldn't fault it.
Going back to the Margaret Thatcher moments as well. I mean, my son and I are, as you're aware, huge, huge Hamilton fans. Obviously, just seen it on Broadway again.
Margaret Thatcher's not in Hamilton.
No, darling. But wait for it. The Margaret Thatcher moment is absolutely, definitely a homage to the moments in Hamilton where we have the King George, where the stage, it changes, there's a backdrop, we don't see all that ensemble and all that stuff that's gone before, and we have this quiet moment. And even some of the chords, the arrangement of the chords and the music at that point, at the start of the Margaret Thatcher section, was a slightly inverted version of the King George numbers. Just the silence and the poise and the way in which it's done, it's very clever. There were a couple of moments there where we looked at each other, we were like, oh my God, it's like a rip-off of the King George song. It was so funny, absolutely brilliant. And really, she really, really connected with the audience, and the audience just went with it. And it was lovely because it all the other songs are pretty much songs as we know them, different arrangements, a lovely mix. Some of them are a lovely fusion of harmonies between two different sort of 80s pop songs that we know, or rock songs, and then they kind of fused together. But this was something that was completely different, isolated, and really stood out, and for that reason was a fantastic moment. And then juxtapose, and then we go back into the band stuff and everyone, an ensemble and lots of voices. But yeah, some beautiful moments on the Margaret Thatcher. But yeah, I like that as well. And like with the Boy George, and you know, again, it was just a suggestion. It was just a hint at the Freddie Mercury Bohemian Rhapsody moment as well, but without going into, like you said, a caricature or a character. It was just an homage to that person, that moment, which was really good, I thought, and worked really well.
It did work really well, and that was one of the things I said to Luke. One of the things is as well about the Maggie Thatcher. I wish you wore the wig.
Yeah.
The big blonde wig, because then it was full kind of like, yeah, I am Maggie Thatcher, I am this woman. But anyway, going off from that, just a question. When you saw it, were there people singing along to the songs?
I was at the end.
Were you singing along?
I was at the end of a row. There were three songs where I kind of mouthed the words, but I would never vocalise it because I know how much that irritates me. And I know that irritated me at Tina. But I think definitely at the end, you know, once everyone was literally, it was a standing ovation. There was no question about it. You know, when sometimes people hesitate or you get a pocket of three and then two people over there, it was like, literally, we knew it was the end. We all stood. It was like, and we all stand up. This is not a question. This is a complete feeling that we all have right now. And it was a standing ovation. I think at that point, then people are singing along. I was singing as I left the theatre, and so many people were like, I love that. This woman, never met before, she turned around and she was like, did you love that? And I was like, have I just been saying I love that really loudly? No, I hadn't said anything at that point, but I think she just wanted to reach out to someone that wasn't just her husband next to her and say, did you like that? I loved it. She just wanted to tell anyone that she really enjoyed it. And I think that was the vibe coming out. Everyone just loved it. Yeah.
I think there was nothing not to love. And also the thing is, again, to the singing along, that was one of the concerns, I think, from the directing team, is stopping people from... But it's not a jukebox musical in that sense. And I think the orchestrations were done so well that they were slightly changed. So singing along would make you look like a bit of an idiot. But I did what you did. I mouthed some of the songs. And the woman next to me actually was doing the same, kind of bopping a little bit in our seats. And not out loud, but just having, you know, like singing along with them. And I think that's why in some respects the kind of finale song or the curtain call song is important, because that gives people the opportunity to get on their feet, have a little of a boogie, yeah, and sing along. And that's obviously things like Tina does well, but they do a full medley of songs then. And obviously like I Should Be So Lucky and any of those kind of jukebox musicals where people know the songs, I think they need to offer that to the audience so they get that opportunity to let out that moment where you really want to get impassioned and sing and have a little dance and stuff.
Yeah,
and then you go home in that happy mood, you're lifted, yeah, you know, you're taking that with you.
Yeah, so yes,
it's
you
really,
do because,
really, really important.
Yeah, because it's quite an odd thing, isn't it? Like you wouldn't go to a concert and, I mean, depending on the artist, I do prefer to be standing when I go to a concert for that reason, because, you know, when you hear great music, you just want to move. I'm a mover. You know, it's hard to sit still, but in a concert, as in a music concert, as in, you know, a string quartet or something like that, you know, you're expected to just sit still, not tap your foot or anything like that. But something like this, where the music is incredible and you know the songs, it is hard to not tap your hand or move something in some way, because that's what music does. It moves you quite literally. I was at the back of the dress circle, so I didn't have anyone behind me, so my head was going a little bit, which was nice. It didn't affect anyone because I was at the end of the row as well, so So that was great. The woman in front of me, she was going for it a bit. And I've got long legs, so my knees were resting on her seat. So I had to keep adjusting my knees because she was bopping slightly out of time to what I would have liked, which was in time with the music. So I did have to move my knees because it's one thing to have your own rhythm, but to have someone else's thrust upon you is not so enjoyable.
No, I bet. But going on their website and just looking at, actually, it's interesting. I saw on Instagram for the old Vic, and they're saying if you tag a video of the curtain call or photos of the curtain call, they will repost it. So they're encouraging people, obviously not during the performance, because that's definitely not a good thing. But at the end, because obviously that's free PR. You know, people need it, and that's why, you know, myself included, I do like to do a little curtain call photo, and it helps promote the show, especially the ones I like. If I don't like the show, then I won't do anything. But you know, if I like something, I want people to see it, I will help support it. But I've just looked in the credits. The Nederlander Theatres are part of the production team, and they own the Dominion. So I wonder whether or not, if it transfers, it will go to somewhere like the Dominion. And that would be a fantastic space to put this kind of show. You know, that whole live band element. Oh, yeah. It'd be wonderful.
Because we've talked about the Dominion before. And do you remember where I was saying that I feel like the Dominion can feel a bit soulless? Like when I saw Bat Out of Hell and White Christmas, even Prince of Egypt, although that kind of filled it because the cast was humongous. But yeah, that can feel a little bit soulless, but this would fill it. It would. The music would reach to the far walls of that. But yeah, absolutely loved it.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's it for this week then. And I guess I will catch up with you properly when I get back from Berlin.
Yes, have a safe journey. And danke schön for joining me from Deutschland.
Why not grab a ticket to one of the shows mentioned in this podcast? Tune in next time and recommend us to your friends and family.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Theatre Audience Podcast and on Twitter at Theatre Audie Pod. Until the next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.